Hello and welcome to another episode of the We Have a Meeting podcast. So today, we're very lucky to be joined by an incredible mind. Kicking off their career at Rolls-Royce, our guest found their passion in the startup world with Quarter Q, fueling his enthusiasm for entrepreneurship. Now he's the force behind deal origination, execution and portfolio management at Octopus Ventures. Octopus Ventures is one of the largest and most active venture capital investors in Europe, working with companies like Depop and Zoopla, to name a few. Today's guest is going to give us a peek behind the curtain in venture capital. It's Edward Keelan. Edward, how are you?
Yeah, good. Thanks very much for having us on this Friday afternoon. So appreciate that.
No worries. Thank you for joining us. So we start the podcast the same way every time. So I'll ask you the same question. Who are you? And what problem do you solve?
Oh, that's a big question, isn't it? That's a big question. So my name's Edward Keelan, as you kindly intro'd me, and I'm a partner within Octopus Ventures, one of the most active VCs in Europe. And what problem do I solve? I mean, I think the great thing about the VC world is that you're kind of solving lots of problems all the time. But I guess the ultimate problem that we're solving is how to allocate capital into the kind of UK's growing tech companies. That's our main goal, is to invest into the kind of the people, the industries and the ideas that are going to change the world for the better. So we do that by partly allocating capital and then also trying to also allocate some of our expertise as well.
Okay, fantastic. And then let's probably go a little bit more symptomatic. So who are the kind of people, what kind of symptoms do they have, what kind of industries, where are they at on their journey for them to say, you know what, Edward's going to come to them and say, let's give you some money and boost this?
Yeah, I mean, Octopus Ventures invests in lots and lots of different things. And I should say we're part of the Octopus Group. So I've been at Octopus now for, over 15 years, so quite a long time. And so, yeah, we're part of the Octopus Group, which owns Octopus Energy as well. So, which is actually much younger than the group. So the group's been around for like 20 years and Octopus Energy has been only around for about seven. But now if I say that I work for Octopus, everyone assumes I work for an energy company. And I have to say, well, no, actually for the first decade of my time at Octopus, everyone sort of looked at me and wondered what was this oddly named company? And now everyone just assumes I work for an energy company. But I don't. I work for the investment side of the business. And we invest at Octopus Group in lots of different things. So lots of renewable energy, a lot of real estate, affordable housing, all with that theme of trying to do things that are going to change the world for the better. So, hence why we're doing things like affordable housing and renewable energy. And so then within the venture capital arm specifically, so we're investing in a very early stage tech company. So right at the kind of forefront, new ideas, all the way from the very first check that might go into a company through to about companies when they may be up to maybe 10 million revenues, but still considered small, you know, still in their growth phase. And we do that across a number of sectors. So maybe that's health tech or deep tech or fintech, consumer tech. And I work in what is definitely the most cool of all of those sectors, which is the B2B software team. So I invest purely in enterprise software. So that's companies that sell technology to each other rather than sort of consumer products or marketplaces like cool things like Depop and Zoopla that you mentioned at the start. So, yeah, that's what I'm investing in. I tend to invest at that growth phase, so where companies have already found what they call product market fit, so they've all already kind of found a product they can sell, maybe they're a few million pounds worth of revenue, and now they're on the next phase of their journey. You know, you often it's a they're transitioning from what they call founder-led sales to team-led sales, so they're going from like scrappy founders selling to anybody they know, and now they actually need to put some efficiencies and processes and all these things in place, and we can help with that. So a lot of what I do is kind of taking a plan and helping founders think about that plan and helping founders think about, okay, where do I lay my next pound? Is that hiring more salespeople? Is it working on the technology? Is it et cetera, et cetera? And then what does good look like in order to know whether I'm on track? And that's really what we're trying to do.
I want to keep going on that and push you a bit further, Edward, because me and my business partner, and we have a meeting, we sit down with a lot of B2B SaaS and tech, and they are on that journey of startup, or they might be having those problems of, I don't want to hire a team, or I do want to hire a team, I want to train the team. So you've got these people, they've now got this money. What is that next step? What kind of problems are they facing when it comes to growing the team and sales? And talk me through what that actually looks like.
I mean, there are so many different problems, and there are so many different scenarios. So it's hard to just pinpoint one. But I'll try and sort of break it down into maybe a few. So the first one I would say especially with B2B software, is they start to lose product market fit. So what you find is companies start to lose product market fit. And by that, what I mean is that they have a great product, it's solving a problem, but then something new and shiny comes up and it's like, oh my gosh, if we just win this £500,000 contract for this bank or whatever, they want us to build something that's kind of tangential to what we're building, but it's actually quite different, but we'll get £500,000 in, or whatever that number might be. And then before they know it, they go off in all different directions, and that kind of core vision that they had for their product kind of slightly goes out the window. And before they know it, they have 5 or 6 different products, and now they've got something which is really hard to scale. So they move from kind of a product-led vision into a kind of Frankenstein of technology, building almost like a consulting company for lots of different people. And so that's often a big danger at that point as you're starting to grow. And then the next bit is this kind of, that they often get stuck into this round, this kind of merry-go-round of salespeople. So the founder is all passion, all enthusiasm, is going to sell to anybody, going to use every, thing they can use. And then they're like, well, I'm too busy now, I need to hire a head of sales. And the head of sales comes in, and actually they're not quite as passionate, they're not quite as enthusiastic, they haven't got so much invested in it working. And maybe the product actually wasn't quite ready to scale yet. And so they then think, right, well, I need to hire a sales team. And so before you know it, you've got this company that was doing really well, but now it's not doing so well, yet it's hired 5 or 6 salespeople. It's like, what? Hang on a sec, it should be selling right now. But in fact, we're selling less than we were when it was just the founder and a few kind of scrappy original employees. And often that happens because you've got product market fit, but you haven't got go-to-market fit. So you've got the kind of, your product has got the right vision, but it's, you're not communicating the problem strong enough. And often there's a breakdown between the marketing and sales team. And so what you end up with is kind of a very outbound based sales team, because there's just no leads coming in. And that's really, really, demotivating to salespeople if they're just having to absolutely make 20 phone calls to get half a lead in, and, all that sort of thing. So a lot of the time what we're doing is we're coming into companies and going, okay, like, what is your core proposition? What is the core thing you're solving? What is the reason people call you to solve their problem? Mm-hmm. Focus on that first. And then once you've really understood that, start to market to that problem so that you're getting lead generation in. So you can then start to build a sales team much, much slower than you were intending. But when they do, they've got leads to work with, and they've got things to sell. That's the kind of common problem I see, is that either the company gets sidetracked with all the new and shiny things going on, or they just try and expand their sales teams way too fast before they really have that sales flywheel nailed down.
That's so refreshing to hear that from somebody in the other world, because that's what I typically hear from founders, and that is like founder-led sales. They're so passionate, they bring someone else in, it doesn't work, and then they're kind of like, they bring in more resources, but then they're slowed down or they're no further along. So what do you think is, and I'm guessing it's not the same for every company, but for someone that's been doing this a long time, you must have a bit of a blueprint or a kind of magic formula up your sleeve. What do you think for lead generation? What is the blueprint? Where should the money be spent? Where should the money not be spent?
Yeah, I definitely don't have a blueprint. and at the stage of company I'm at, I'm slightly allergic to blueprints. So I have a lot of go-to-market type consultants that pitch to us, that want to come in and work with our companies, which is fine, it's good, and some of them are really good and some of them are not so good. But when they build out the kind of model with all the kind of buzzwords on it, that's kind of I've just seen so many of them, let's just say. I've seen so many of them. And I think that and none of them start, or very rarely do they start with actually what the problem is. And so often it's like, okay, what we need to do is we need to look at the pipeline, then we need to look at your sales team, look at your recruitment process, look at what you're doing. And I'm like, actually, no. Before any of that, what you need to do is go, is this product any good? Like, is the product actually any good? Because it doesn't matter. Somebody once said that, you know, a great sales team will be able to sell things, sell something that isn't very good. And I think maybe in the past that was true. I think now it's very hard to sell rubbish, really hard to sell rubbish. And also, you know, a lot of the business models we're working with are based on retention. And if you're selling rubbish, rubbish in, rubbish out, you know, you'll just, you solving churn by selling more is not a good idea. That is, you know, it's too expensive to solve churn with sales. So the first thing you need to do is go like, let's not spend any money until we know that this product is absolute kick-ass and people actually want it. So my first blueprint is like, why are they going to call you? Not why do you call them? Why is the customer calling you to solve their pain? Because if you cannot answer that, it's extraordinarily difficult to sell somebody, especially in this market. I mean, the macro environment is horrible right now. Yeah, try selling somebody some software that they didn't know that they wanted, or to a problem that they didn't know they had. You know, before you've even hired a salesperson or whatever, it's just nigh on impossible. You know, so, and that, I think, you know, the biggest reason people don't buy B2B software in particular is because of apathy, because it's much cheaper to do absolutely nothing and stick with what they've got. So, you know, my first blueprint is that, and then it's about, okay, you know, let's get leads in, let's see, add one or two salespeople, and let's see if we can make the metrics work with two or three salespeople. What you cannot do is get 10, because then your senior leaders are just going to spend the whole time training 10 salespeople. You've got no idea how good they are. And it has the reverse effect. You have this diseconomies of scale effect where nobody knows what they're doing. Everyone is just kind of flying around trying to sell things. And the truth is, if you know the 10-person sales team gets nowhere near their quota and barely recovers their own costs, that's just not scalable. So no. So again, that's kind of the next part of my blueprint is prove out that go-to-market fit with one or two people to start with, then build the formula, and then start adding heads on top. But what tends to happen is we've missed that middle loop. So especially over the last few years, is companies have really missed that middle bit where we go, let's just add three or four. And when they're so busy that they just cannot cope with so much work, we'll then add people. What they've done is they've gone, let's just hire 20 people and see what happens, because our VCs want us to scale at 10 times the speed, etc. And that is a recipe for disaster.
You sound, so tell me from past experience or maybe from studying or reading, you sound like a salesman, Edward. Your methodology sounds like a salesman that I trust, problem-centric. You're saying all the right things.
I mean, I think I've always got, I think sales is the lifeblood of any company. But I think the same thing actually applies to tech. you know, I think that you can say a lot of the same things, with technology teams. You know, technology teams have oversized themselves massively over the last few years. And what's happened is tech development has slowed down. Rather than having one or two, you know, developers sleeping under the desk and working their absolute, you know, every hour God sends, you've ended up with huge teams of tech people being, you know, again, with that diseconomies of scale effect. They're just not effective. One plus one does not equal two. But that all said, I have worked in sales. I've done sales. I was employee number one of a startup. So you had no choice but to do sales at that point. Everyone was. And I've worked in fundraising. And, you know, I think when I was at university, I sold insurance insurance over the phone and things like that. So there is part of me that thinks that everybody should spend at least a year in sales, especially anybody that thinks they're going to run a business, to really understand how hard it is. It's like the most unappreciated skill, I think, that we have in the UK's kind of enterprise ecosystem, because people don't realize how hard it is to make 30 calls in a day and get rejected and, you know, not hit the right targets and all of this sort of stuff. You know, it's one of those positions where it's very, very hard to hide. You know, if the tech team says, I'm sorry, it's going to be delayed a month because of X, Y, and Z, most of the rest of the room doesn't know what they're talking about. The sales team says, oh, we haven't got anywhere near our quotas. Everyone understands what that means.
Yeah.
There is nowhere to hide.
Interesting. Okay. And then you alluded to it earlier, the pressure from VCs. I guess if we pull back the curtain and we look at it from your angle, obviously it is a business. There has to be a return. What does that communication look like? What does that pressure look like? Because I can't imagine you're breathing down someone's neck saying hire 30 more salespeople. But what does it look like on that relationship side of things?
I think the relationship between VCs and companies has changed so much over the last few years. So we have been on a massive roller coaster, like a crazy roller coaster over the last few years. So if you just sort of step back, I'm sure you know this, but like at a high level, you know, pandemic ends, pandemic starts, people think the world's going to end and that like the economy is over forever and all the rest of it. And we all kind of had a nice summer and that first year of the pandemic and all that. And then in about September time, everyone was like, hang on a sec, we are going to carry on working. We're going to work from home and then technology is going to be where it's at. And so all of a sudden, all these technology companies just went crazy. So valuations, we used to pay sort of 5x annual recurring revenues for a SaaS business, a software as a service business. That was going to 15, 20 times. And then as those valuations creeped up, you then had this huge amount of money coming in from big American hedge funds and SoftBanks and Tiger Capital and all this sort of thing. And their idea was, we're going to pump these companies full of money and then flip them into IPO. And because SaaS companies are the hot thing, everyone's hot favorite right now, you know, there was always that next layer of money, and that was the IPO market. And so because of that, and I'm talking about the wider VC ecosystem, I'm not taking all the blame for this, Jack. But because of that, VCs were putting on a lot of pressure to companies to say, you need to grow quickly. In fact, you know, I want you to grow really, really fast, because if you can get to 100% growth, I can value you at 20 times your recurring revenues or whatever that number might be. And then the IPO market crashed completely. So IPOs just aren't happening now for the last 18 months. Just haven't. You know, it's got very difficult. The wider macro environment's got very, very difficult. And as the IPO market's crashed, valuation comparables have got crashed. And actually, we're now back down to where we were before, about 5x kind of recurring revenues. So, you know, if you were a company during that period, you were kind of like 5x recurring revenues. Oh, now we're 15x recurring. We've just trebled the value of this business and we've raised tons of cheap equity. There's a massive shortage of people. And our VCs are telling us to like spend like money's going out of fashion so that we can grow to get onto the IPOs. And then it all crashes. But these companies are left with human capital, left with people and valuations that have now gone down a third from where they raised 18 months ago. And now the VC story, and again, I talk about the wider environment, not just us. The VC's kind of narrative is now, hey, where's your capital efficiency? You know, there is nowhere to put you. There is no next market. You know, there's no real M&A market. There's no IPO market. So you need to get capital efficient and profitable ASAP, please. But what does that mean? That means laying people off, and that means reducing cost. And, you know, you look at layoffs.io, which does a great job at mapping layoffs. I mean, the layoffs have been crazy within tech, and that is all because of this huge bubble created by that sort of cheap capital that was coming in largely from US hedge funds. And I think it's been a bit of a cold bath for founders. I think it's been a cold bath for VCs, and they've had to change their narrative to say, you know, actually, we need to go back and think about investing the money sensibly that we put in and not hire 20, 30 salespeople after day one and make sure there's go-to-market fit. It's interesting because I'm reading the book The Founders at the moment. I don't know if you've read that book, The Founders. It's the PayPal story.
Okay.
And The Founders, it's 2001, and Peter Thiel is like decided that actually the right thing to do is aim for profitability and he'll dye his hair blue. And you know, it's amazing to me that like 2001, PayPal decides to go for capital efficiency when the market goes, you know, and the same thing. It's just 20 years later, the market's repeated itself almost identically to what it did there. So, you know, with all of that, the narrative changes. Hopefully that, yeah, I say everyone's taken a bit of a cold bath, we'll learn the lessons and we try and be much more kind of cost conscious and not. I mean, from a personal point of view, I'm always conscious that if you ramp up headcount and you reduce headcount, what you're doing is people's lives. You
know? Yeah, of course. Yeah, it's
a real human cost to that.
That's interesting. I've seen that quite a few times over the last few years with companies. So it's interesting to hear it from both sides of the coin. Do you, has that changed when it comes to new businesses now and investment? What change has that had when it comes to investing in new businesses and startups and choosing who you think might be a right fit for yourselves?
Well, I think that, you know, there is still a hangover from 21, 22, and if you talk to a founder and they still think they're worth 15 times recurring revenues and they still want to grow at, you know, 200% by taking your money and hiring 20 salespeople within the first, you know, 2 months. I think for me that you making sure you're on the same page as that founder, making sure you're both thinking, like, this doesn't do either of us any good if our valuation is like so high that we can never get any future investment, or, you know, we hire so many people that we will spend our whole time just hiring and firing people and not actually growing. So you have to make sure that the founders are on the same wavelength, is what I would say, and being much more cognizant of that than ever before.
Okay. I want to take it down a different angle. So, from someone that works in the lead generation world, I'm a big fan of cold calling. That's basically predominantly what we do, but also email, LinkedIn and things like that. I've seen far too many Hollywood films where people are getting investment and there's always like a crazy story of how they turned up at someone's office and they refused to leave until they got investment or things like that. But when it comes to people approaching Octopus and approaching yourself, I'm sure you must get bombarded on a regular basis in your LinkedIn feed and in your DMs and your email box. What is the right way? If a founder is looking to stand out as somebody that's a strong option for investment, what should they be doing? What's the best way to take it? What do they need to do?
Yeah, I mean, there is the numbers really talk for themselves. I can't remember them exactly. I was about to say, so I'll make them up, but I can't remember.
make them up, Edward.
I'll make them up. It's like less than half a percent of cold approaches. It's less than half a percent or whatever.
That's mental.
They get them from cold approaches that will get VC investment. It's just because, I mean, if I look at my inbox now, I've probably got half a dozen. You know, there just are so many approaches you get. It's actually easy for me because I only invest in B2B software companies that do at least £1 million worth of recurring revenue and that have UK operations and that are growing at a reasonable size. So, like, it's easy for me. Some of my colleagues are investing in consumer businesses at the early stages. How many decks do they get every day? Huge amounts. So I think if I was saying anything, you know, like, If you want to approach a VC, what I would do is I would look on your LinkedIn, you know, see who you're connected to. And if you've got any sort of connection on LinkedIn, try and do it at least a little bit warm. You know, some VCs now say, well, we don't take any warm intros. We only do it cold because we want to be fair. But the truth is that that's the minority. The vast majority don't. The vast majority go take warm intros because there's just too many otherwise to get through. And so, yeah, even if it's somebody that's kind of like, I don't know, went to university with the VC and you say, oh, you know, I see you're connected with him. Can you or her, you know, can you get me an intro or can you get me to let them send me my deck or whatever? And then what I'd say is, and somebody came at an event on Tuesday night, and somebody said this, which I thought was really useful feedback, which was every single time you send your deck and if you get kind of traction, then make sure you try and get feedback, detailed feedback if possible, not to try and convince the VC otherwise, but to then go, okay, can I change my deck? Can I improve it? You know, because you shouldn't be dogmatic. You know, a lot of VCs see thousands of decks and they don't always get it right. I thought Octopus Energy was a terrible idea, so there you go. VCs definitely don't always get it right. But they might give you a few nuggets of feedback about how you can change things, how you can adapt things, etc. And so therefore, you know, go to your least favorite VCs first, and then by the time you've got to the ones you really want to target, you've got a warm intro to, your deck's kind of really nailed on.
That's good advice. Is there anything anecdotally that you've passed up on and now you're kicking yourself, or you think,
my regret portfolio is way better than my actual portfolio, but then that's hindsight, isn't it? So
yeah.
My regret portfolio is everything I've never invested into that I've seen. So I think my favorite one was probably Huel, passed on Huel. So who wants to eat dust? I mean, generally they seem to have done pretty well. I saw Free Trade at a really, really early, like basically at concept stage, and they were looking for investment. That would have been I think they raised around at like $500 million. So it could have come in right at the very start. That would have been nice. You try not to have too many regrets, you know.
You can't live in the past. Okay. And for you let's talk about the B2B UK operation, $1 million. Do they have to be, obviously they're probably going to have to be problem centric and be really kind of clued up when it comes to what problem they solve and kind of where they're at. But are there any biases that you have towards like what kind of things they're changing in the world, or what is it that says, you know what, this is going to be a brilliant idea, I need to get on board with this?
Yeah, I mean, we do have a slight bias towards companies that would be, you know, very directly are changing the world for the better. You know, that is, you know,
it's a good bias.
Yeah, it's a good bias. It's not a prerequisite, but it kind of aligns with our corporate values and our B Corp status. And so, you know, that will, and we also just think that we're optimistic, overly optimistic, but we do sort of believe that those companies are the ones that are going to be the next generation of companies. I think consumers, not all consumers, but generally consumers and investors long term, you know, want to invest and be part of that next phase of company. Like I don't think there's a massive, like, you know, back in the 80s, everybody wanted to invest in oil companies and banks and, you know, really kind of pretty, you know, mean stuff maybe. And now I think that there's a kind of much more, people want to see their money going to good use and want to see their money going to companies that are going to make a difference. So we have a slight bias on that. We like things that are really integrated in the workflows of how people are kind of operating. So what we say is like not widgety software. So something that kind of sticks and actually really works time and time again. And we'll have a bias to that. So we look at things like net revenue retention and gross revenue retention and those sorts of metrics to say, right, the customers love this product. Do they truly love it? Can we see that they're using it time again? That's kind of where my team in particular is looking.
And I'm sure that you've had presentations, cred decks, lunches, meetings with some incredible founders over the years. If you were to take all the different personality traits and create the perfect founder or visionary leader, what kind of traits do they have? They could even be cons that can be used as pros, I guess.
Do you know what? I don't really like doing the kind of archetypical type founder, because you end up in this kind of like, it'll look a bit like Hollywood type, you know, like Steve Jobs or something like that. And I just think that's lots of different founders, lots of different personalities make good founders for different businesses. I think the ones that I'm, you know, things, the ones I'm most wary of are the ones that just are out of reality of where things are, you know, just they see a different reality to where things are. So, you know, you'd think of like an Adam Newman at WeWork or something like that, where you just like, you don't see the reality of what is actually happening here. That's really, really scary. And often VCs will get a bad name because they'll be like, oh, they just didn't see the vision. They couldn't see it. They just cared about the numbers. But the companies that then succeed, where the VC didn't see them, you know, didn't see the vision, and they did, and they just saw the numbers. For all of those, there was many, many companies that thought they had a vision and the whole thing failed because they wouldn't actually look at the detail. Many, many more as well. Lots more fail because of. So I think you want a founder that is both visionary but also pragmatic and also really understands what's driving their business and, you know, what funding that they need to achieve what they're trying to, is what I would say.
Okay. What's one common misconception about venture capital that, that people always get wrong?
Oh, that's a good question. I think that it's quite, people sort of see it as quite homogenous. They sort of see it as like you're a VC and therefore you just invest in everything. And the truth is most VCs focus on specific things and specific stages. And, you know, because you sort of have to, because like I said, like for our team focusing on enterprise software at growth stage, it'd be impossible to try and be all things to all people. But then it's also very difficult to offer advice to founders because you wouldn't have the case studies to kind of fall back on to sort of educate them on or to help them with. So I'd probably say that you need to understand that not all the same. And also that means that if you get lots and lots of rejections, that doesn't mean to say that the next one you've just might be happening to look for what you're trying to provide, you know? I'd probably say that.
It is sales at a point. It's hard because your cred deck, you've created it, your business, your problem. There is a level of it feels personal because they're rejecting you, but at times it's sometimes you're not the right fit. So I get from somebody that talks about rejection on a daily basis, I get what you're saying. Edward, I could quiz you on this all day. I feel like it's been a brilliant conversation. I guess for anyone that's listening and thinking about going down the VC route, what are the three things that a founder should know before they start out on this journey?
So if you're a founder and you're looking for VC investment, I think you need to understand there's a bit of a VC hierarchy of needs. So a little bit like Maslow's hierarchy.
Move over Maslow, yeah.
Exactly. Like I've got a slide in some of the presentations I do with a VC hierarchy of needs because all VCs say that the founders are the most important thing. All of them do. Don't necessarily define what that means. And classically, it's nine impossible to actually dictate what a good founder looks like. But it does need to be somebody, in my mind, who can really eloquently tell you what the problem is they're solving. Not necessarily in the most charismatic way, but in a way that I understand. Because if I don't understand it, the people they hire aren't going to understand it, and the people they're trying to sell to aren't going to understand it. So I want somebody that can really explain the problem and the solution, and then somebody that I think will take the rest of the team, will be able to hire people, will hire talent and take those people with them on that journey. Because if I don't think, well, would I work for that person? I'm not sure. Then, you know, as you scale, you can't find the talent and you can't do so. So, you know, if that's kind of what I'm thinking about with founders. In terms of the going back to that hierarchy, number one, we've already sort of talked about, which is like, is this the VC who is actually going to invest in my business? You know, I once got a guy called me up because he was doing like a medical device thing. And I said, I'm really sorry, don't invest in medical devices. And telling me the reason why the UK ecosystem isn't going to work. I'm like, you might have the best medical device system in the entire world that's going to revolutionize everything. I do not invest in medical devices because I don't understand them. You know, so you have to have the right investor for the stage you're at. Then I would say the market needs to be big enough that you're playing in, you know, and being honest about it. So a lot of people frame the market as the entire sector or the problem that they're solving, you know, like, oh, we solve the food waste problem, which is $1 trillion. It's like, yeah, but you're solving a tiny, 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 tiny bit of the food waste problem, not the whole of it. Therefore, you know, you're not VC backable. So ultimately the VC model is to back companies that could be worth £1 billion one day. If your total market is only £10 million, then you might be a great niche business. You know, my wife's a private chef and she's got a great business, but the market size for her is pretty small, like really small for her little niche business. It's not bad business, it's a great business, but it's not VC backable. So you need the market size that is VC backable. And then there's lots of, what's the next part of the hierarchy of needs that you could choose from? There's tons of stuff. But, you know, I think probably for me, it comes down to that problem and solution. So, you know, what is the difference between, what's the step change that your solution is providing? You know, and if it's incremental, if it's a little widget that makes your website slightly faster or marketing a little bit better, it's probably not going to be enough. I want something that's going to make at least three times difference on what people are doing now.
Mm.
That's the sort of level you need to get to for change to happen and to scale.
I agree. Edward, I've really enjoyed this conversation. Thank you for taking the time. If anybody wants to, I'm not going to say cold email you or cold message you, because the chances of...
You could, slim... it could be like, I got an intro from Jack via his podcast. And
there we go.
Have a look at this.
It counts as warm. You're hearing it now. If anybody does want to check you out or check out Octopus Ventures or switch their energy over to Octopus Energy, how can they find you? How can they find Octopus?
It's not difficult to find Octopus Energy. I think just look out your window at the moment.
Billboards everywhere.
I think I'm customer number 50, which always freaks their customer service line out. but no, if anybody wants to contact me on LinkedIn, then feel free to do so. I'm pretty active on LinkedIn.
Amazing. Thank you so much.
No worries. Thanks, Jack.